Hello, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I am one of your hosts, Jess Geyer. I'm one half of Wannabe Games, and I make role-playing games. And I'm here with my co-host, as always. Hello, Craig.
Hi, Jess. I am Craig. Craig Campbell. I am the owner of Nerd Burger Games, and I also make some of those tabletop role-playing games. And as always, as promised, we are on part three. It's going to become part four, as it turns out, coming up. But part three of brand new guest series here. Steffi, hello. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me. So I'm Steffi Devan. I'm a freelance developer and writer of role-playing games, and I've written for a bunch of stuff that you have probably heard of or played, including Craig's cyberpunk capers game, but also lots of stuff for Gathermind Gaming. I did a module for Wizards of the Coast. I've written for Vampire the Masquerade. Welcome to Night Vale coming up. And the My Little Pony game, amongst other things.
Awesome.
I forgot about the Welcome to Night Vale thing. That I've become excited all over again.
Yeah, that's going to be amazing.
Well, then you sound like the perfect person to be talking about our two subjects for the day. We are talking about GMing in and designing in a world that is not completely our own, existing IPs and known worlds. Craig, do you want to introduce the topic a little bit before we bounce it over to Steffi and ask her what she thinks about the topic at large?
This is one of those ones that I haven't really done myself, so I'm a little at a loss of what to say. I suspect what some of the pitfalls are. Although I've GM'd in known worlds, but I haven't designed for an IP. But I think, you know, as designers, as game designers, we enjoy a luxury at times. And as GMs, we enjoy a luxury when it's all ours. Like you can make it all up yourself. You can make things up on the fly. You can rewrite things, you can piece something together in the moment. The players can have a lot of say in what's being developed. Like they're only as limited as much as like you'll kind of take the reins off of them and let them kind of develop things for the world. But when you're dealing with a known world, there's a lot of expectation that comes with it. There's a lot of material that's already produced. There's sometimes conflicting material and what's canon and what's not, and what the players will accept and what the IP is looking for out of a design. And so there's a lot of kind of trials and tribulations and pitfalls associated with just dealing with all of that other stuff. And it can be especially if you are not personally an expert top to bottom on whatever the world or IP is, it can be daunting to be like, I want to do this thing, but can I? Does it make sense? Steffi, this was your choice of topics. So what, mm-hmm. What obviously your resume draws you to this kind of a topic.
Yeah.
But let's go ahead and start with you with your initial thoughts on GMing in a known world.
So for GMing, I have a how not to anecdote in a minute, but I think the most important thing is to sit your players down, ask expectations, and specifically ask how much they want the main cast, like the canonical cast, to be a part of the adventure. Like, do you want Buffy to be off to university somewhere and you are also a slayer? And you know of her, but that's it? Or do you want to be a classmate and she is the Slayer and you're like playing a second Cordelia, which makes for a vastly different game depending on what you choose, because plenty of times players want to play in that world, but they don't want to play second fiddle, which brings me to my don't anecdote, because I was in a game once, a Firefly game, based on the TV series Firefly. With the spaceship and the anyway, and we were playing the Battle of Serenity that happens before the series ever starts. And every time we came up with a wild plan to save the day, the GM literally says, that doesn't work because that's not how it happened. And we were like, so why are we here? What are we doing? Why are our characters here? If you already know exactly what's going to happen, and every time, because sometimes we came up with a plan and we rolled amazingly, or we came up with a plan and it just really fit what our characters were good at. So the results were amazing. And we'd had basically what most people would call like a critical success on our roles. And the DM would just be like, no, but it didn't happen that way, so it doesn't work. And I remember walking away from the table being so frustrated and saying to another player, like, what was that? Why were we, what were we doing? Why were our characters there? So that is the do not. Once you introduce new characters into the world, you have to assume that they might change what happened in that world. And if you're not okay with that, then, you know, either don't do it or maybe tell your players ahead of time. But yeah, they're going to influence what happens, because once you're running a game, they are the stars and not the characters from the show.
That's a really good point, especially if you are trying to play like a major touchstone in an existing IP. Like, I'm thinking about the Rogue One movie that came out. Everyone knows what happens at the end to all of these people. However, you're set up knowing that, and that's part of the adventure. It sounds like you weren't set up to play that game knowing that you weren't going to actually ultimately be able to impact the ending of this battle. If everyone were on board, maybe things would have been a little bit nicer.
Yeah, mind, we weren't even trying to win the Battle of Serenity. We were trying to evacuate more people, which would have made no difference on the TV series. You know, it makes no difference if Mal and his crew are the only people to escape, or if 10 ships escape. Makes no difference. But the GM was like, no, but only Mal escapes, so none of this, you can't evacuate anyone. So it would be like, if Rogue One, if not, so you have all the adventures and you delivered plans to Leia and then you die, right? Which is fine. But if everything up to that point is also written in stone, so it isn't just you deliver the plans to Leia and then you die, but every moment, every step of that journey is like, no, but in Rogue One, it happened this way. No, but in Rogue One, it happened this way. No, but in Rogue, why am I doing this? Why am I in this game?
Why don't we just watch Rogue One?
It's a great movie. Let's do that. But yeah, so, you know, you can GM it and work up to an outcome, but then move all the variables around and be like, yeah, no, you're still going to lose the Battle of Serenity, but you evacuate a bunch of people. Lots of folks survive because of you.
Could set up a really interesting story too. Like, somebody escapes that in the actual canon of the show you didn't think would happen, and then you could either play like an alternate timeline, or here's what's happening on this side of the screen when you don't get to see it when you're watching TV show. You're telling an alternate version, which is, I think, when I play a game in an existing IP, like when I play a Star Wars game, I don't want to play side by side with Luke and Leia. I want to play my own people somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, yeah, I think you're exactly right. Like, you want to be, you, the players should be the stars. And as much as you love the main cast, like you love Mal and the crew of the Fire, you love all of that in Firefly, but you can't love them more than your players.
Yeah, exactly. And like, you should be able to save Uncle Owen. And then in the universe, Luke thinks they are dead and he's traumatized and everything happens as it did. Nothing changes for Luke, except you saved Owen and he just never realized that you did that.
Yeah, won't change anything. And in fact, like, it could even be like, oh, we have this prophecy among the Jedi that he's going to go and do this. So we can't let him know that he's off on this adventure for no reason.
Like, yep, exactly.
Yeah, he's got to go. He's got to go and do all the things so that balance gets restored to the Force, however that plays out in your head.
Or you could even be like, you kill the stormtroopers who were busy killing them in the house. And that's the corpses that somehow, like, you remove the uniforms for some sort of stealth mission later on. And those are the corpses. Because really, how do you tell one burnt to a crisp corpse from the other burnt to a crisp corpse? So he thinks...
On a backwater planet, no less.
Exactly. So he thinks his family died, but really they are fine. And you never find a way to contact him and tell him.
I think that something like this will certainly come into play very soon with people who are playing the Dune role-playing game with their groups.
Exactly.
Because there's a very similar thing. Like, all of the Atreides die or get captured. Well, doesn't have to be like that. We are playing in a world and we can move things around. And in fact, I think that's where a lot of the creativity for you as a GM playing in an established world, that's if you want to play in that same timeline, you have now opened things up to you and you can feel a little less constrained. I know for me, when I play in a known world, my fear is that I'm not going to be quote unquote accurate to the story and my mm-hmm. players are going to be upset with me because of that. But in fact, I mean, I wouldn't be upset when they make changes. I think that that's cool. That's where you can still have those elements of surprise, which you really do need if you're playing a role-playing game in general. Otherwise, you're just writing a story or acting out a play.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if going back to June, if Paul is the only thing that really matters and that moves things, then why are we here? Like, you can't score any victories until Paul scores a victory. Like, okay, but why? And you should be able to do more things. And like, I get that you can't change the big, like, he needs to marry the daughter of the emperor and he needs to, oh, spoiler, for it's, a really old book that yeah. people should have read by now.
Or a 50-year-old book.
Exactly, it'll be fine. I don't know, maybe you can do things like, could you save his sister? You know, the one who turns out to be an abomination. Mm-hmm. Like, would you be able to save her? And that would be a drastic change, but I think that would be a cool change to explore. Maybe she was supposed to be Quithas Harrach. You don't know that. Because he always says that he isn't.
Yes, that's so many fun places to explore. Now I want to play a Dune game. I think alternately to escape from this pitfall, if you really don't want to alter those events, you can also pick a part of the timeline before or after the story mm-hmm. happens, especially in a lot of these epic fantasy or even in a fantasy setting like in Firefly. There are places before and after the events of the story that have a little bit of outlining done on them,
yes,
but that you can just like take and grow with. In fact, the IPs themselves have developed and iterated on these. There's a wealth of comics and books for all of these franchises.
Yes. That absolutely.
That your players might not be familiar with unless they're like super fans.
Yeah, you can move in time and space. Just thinking of Firefly, like the series takes place at a particular time and then you jump forward a bit to the movie and then everybody learns what Reavers are. But you could play in the time in between where the Reavers are still a problem, mm-hmm. still a threat. You as players know what Reavers are. You're not going to be able to go fix that because your characters don't know. So the events that lead Mal and the gang to deal with the Reavers and end that whole threat, that gets dealt with down the road later, but you're still having to deal with Reaver attacks.
Yeah, you could play scientists on a planet trying to find a cure for human aggression. And then things go sideways, and then every player at your table is going to be like, holy shit, we did that. But,
oops.
But the characters are like, no, this is a very valiant endeavor. We're trying to eradicate humor. What could possibly go wrong? We are striving for peace. I mean, that would be a really interesting thing to play, because that must have been a wild ride on that planet.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be different than playing Rogue One, where you know, like we at the end we have to deliver the plans and everybody has to die along the way because that's how the story goes. If you know that that's going to be the story, you could play the Firefly game where it's like, we know this is going to go poorly, but we're going to play out this fun drama, this interesting, engaging kind of story of how we get to the point where everything goes sideways. And we as players all know everything's going to go bad in the end. So, but when you get right down to it, we watch movies and read books and comics and everything all the time where we know how it's going to end. When I started watching Star Wars, I said, somebody's going to blow up the Death Star.
Yes.
It's going to happen.
We have websites dedicated to telling us if the dog dies. So, you know. But yeah, and if you play that Firefly scientist Reaver scenario, if your players get overly attached to like one of the subjects, one of the, you know, there's this mom and her son and they're part of the experiment and they really take a liking to them. Yeah, sure. They got those two off planet. Congratulations. And then they had to go into hiding because otherwise they're going to get killed by the people covering up the experiment. But you saved those two. It's fine. It doesn't make a difference for the story.
It can even be more emotional at that point too. Like,
yeah, they might die depending on your group.
And you can take it to a different location and have one thing I was thinking about when you were talking about, like, do you want to play a Slayer? Do you want to play part of Buffy's crew? Like, are you in town with Buffy? Like, you can play a Buffy the Vampire Slayer game where, okay, you've got a group of people, somebody's playing a Slayer, the rest are playing their Scoobies, and you're in Cleveland because there's a Hellmouth there too. And Giles makes a visit to help install the new Slayer in Cleveland's Watcher, and give some advice and be kind of peripheral, because Giles in the show only like does the big moment occasionally. He's very much a support character. So you can have him come in and be the support character. You don't have to have Buffy show up because Buffy's going to be the one who wants to fix everything. You can have early Willow, same way, support character. Later Willow, going to try to fix stuff.
You can always have Xander
show up.
But you can also, you could also bring Buffy and Willow in too. I mean, especially later Willow and Buffy all the time are very much the epitome of, if all you are is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So you can bring them in and have them try to solve the problem and then figure out that no, violence actually doesn't work here.
Yep.
You're going to have to try something else, which means you are back to Sunnydale because you're terrible at this part.
and your thinky planny group is now going to take care of the problem without treating it like a nail.
Yeah, exactly.
You can also put those main characters in peril in a way that they are not able to help you. I'm also a huge fan of like, oh no, something happened to make them evil temporarily. Now you have to fix it and go up against this person without hurting them, without killing them. Because if you do that, everything's screwed.
Yes.
Those are all. And even just making them like, maybe you have like a grudge against this canon character and you don't. You're trying to prove that you're better, or you're from a competing house of the Atreides, and you really don't want Paul to be this chosen one. That's bad for you and your house. There are all sorts of ways that you can include them, but not have the players always want to use them or rely on them too much, or even using them and relying on them. And this is, I think, mostly true for those characters that have immense amount of powers within a canon. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Make it so they aren't relying on them and can't just come in and save everything. I think it's a little easier when you have a cast of characters that's not super all powerful. I'm thinking, just because you said Scooby, now I'm thinking about Scooby-Doo. They're not all powerful. There could definitely be many other mystery machine type characters. What do they call them? What's their name of their group? I forget.
Mystery Inc.
You could have, they're same thing. Like, it's a franchise. Ghostbusters or other things like that. They literally, you could be franchisees. you could be part owners of this franchise.
And it depends a lot on the established, because with Buffy, we established that she is the only one until the end of the series. And, you know, same with Paul Atreides, you get one quiz. Let's hope we only get one. We had the one, it was terrible, never doing it again. but then you've got Supernatural and Scooby-Doo, and there are a bunch of people like them out there. We have hunters all over the place in Supernatural, and you can't tell me that Lucifer is the only demon causing serious trouble. I'm sure there's a lot of them. You could even do, like, depending on the cultural and ethnic background of your group, you might move away from the whole Christian tradition and be like, no, we're going to do hunters, but we're going to pull from our mythology.
And we also have big bads
who want to end the world.
Yes. Alternate places, alternate timelines. These are all great places to go. How do you then, though, deal with a player who knows so much more about this world than you do? They've read everything. They wrote the Wikipedia pages. They really want to play in this world, and they want things to be super accurate. Is there a way to GM for these types of people?
Yeah, but you have to deal with it out of character. You have to sit them down and basically establish, look, if I don't know it exists, it doesn't exist in the game. And I've been on the opposite end, because I used to be in an Exalted group, and I was a huge fan of the setting. So at one point I had read everything, and I was like, oh, I bet this is this. And then at one point the storyteller pulled me aside and was, no, Steffi, I don't know any of this stuff. I've read the core book and the splat books for, like, you know, Sidereals, Abyssals, Dragonblooded. So if it's not in one of those, it is not. Stop trying to railroad my game. I'm like, I'm so sorry. It will never happen again. But that is just a matter of establishing boundaries out of character, just establishing expectations and telling them, I know this and this and this, and that's what the game is built on. I know you know everything else, and that's very cool, but that's not going to be part of this game.
Yeah, I think that that is super reasonable to do with your players. I think you should always be setting boundaries with your players anyway, but you could also invite them in a little bit too, like, hey, what do you think would happen? Like, I'm struggling to come up with a reason for this for happening, or I need a cool NPC. Like, do you have any suggestions? What would be cool to bring in?
That would be amazing. That's an amazing way to handle it. Yeah.
I think that that's true for no matter what you played. I'm glad you brought up like Exalted, and then also in traditional role-playing games, like, for example, you're playing Strahd, like what is the name of that adventure path?
Curse of Strahd.
Well, I can't remember anything today, but you're playing Curse of Strahd and they already have played in it, or they already know about it.
Yep.
Like, what are things that you could do to twist things and make things more interesting? Again, you have a bit of the dramatic irony in that your players know something is up, or they know some of the story beats, but you also want to throw things in their face a little bit to keep things exciting.
Yes, like his wife survived and she is out for revenge because he was terrible.
Or she's one of you.
Oh, that would be, yeah. The mysterious patron you met at a bar who said, like, that Strahd boy is terrible, you need to go kill him. That was her.
Yes.
She's like, I'm not coming anywhere near him because he's a mess. But, you know, someone who's not me should take care of it.
Yeah, that would be perfect. It would be. I would really have fun playing a game like that.
And then for an additional twist, you can make her evil at the end, and she'll be like, "Well, now that the head vampire is gone, we obviously need a new hat vampire. So, that's me."
There you go. Just be a little creative with it. That's basically what it comes down to, is what it sounds like. When you're GMing in a known world, you have a great wealth of resources at your fingertips. People have already created things for you. A little bit of your work's a little easier, but you also have to be very innovative.
Yes. So in a game, you have to manage. First, you have to set the expectations so that everyone knows what we are playing and what is set in stone and everything else. If it's not explicitly said, like, this has to happen, it means it should be open to change. So that should be the default. And then within that, you need to throw in a couple of twists so that they don't know exactly what's going to happen all of the time.
I also would recommend, just as a little side note to anyone who's like nervous about GMing in a world like this, maybe they picked up the Avatar role-playing game or any of the other major IP games that exist out there, go play the Final Fantasy VII reboot and see how they have twisted some things that we know and love about that series, about that game, because I think that they masterfully have done a lot of the things that Steffi has been talking about during this last half hour. What about writing, designing for an existing IP? You're a freelancer. You've been doing this, it sounds like.
Yeah, I've been doing it a lot. So the trickiest part is that once you're designing for some in a licensed IP, the emphasis is licensed, everything goes through approvals. So they will let you know what you can and can't do. For example, I worked on the Stargate RPG and they were super relaxed. So the makers of the game basically pitched, we are on a different planet where we also found a Stargate, and we are using it to explore different planets because it connects to, like, the network connects to Earth, but then from there, that Stargate connects to different Stargates than the Earth Stargate. So basically, we are SG-13. We have nothing to do with SG-1, but we go on similar type missions. So it takes place concurrently. And then later moves into the Atlantis era, but it starts concurrently to SG-1, and you run the same types of adventures as they do, but you don't have to worry about the SG-1 crew because you are off doing different things and different missions in a different part of the galaxy. So we got to design, we of course you stay with the Goa'uld because it is Stargate, But we got to design new species for them, new planets for them. They allowed us to play with existing species and planets. So we were like, oh, yeah, so SG-1 left that planet and this was going on. And then after they left, this more happened. And they were so open to everything and they approved everything. And we had so much room to work with. It was like writing a new season of SG-1 or SG-13, I guess, which was amazing. It was one end of the spectrum where the licensor is just like, no, go ahead, that's fine, yeah, that's fine, yeah, that's fine, because it doesn't touch on if they ever want to reboot. They are going to reboot the Earth Gate or the Atlantis Gate, and we weren't working with those, so they were like, no, that's fine, because nothing you are doing is going to matter if we ever reboot the TV series, so go ahead, it's fine, which was amazing. But yeah, and then on the opposite end of the spectrum, you have licensors who are very, they have their own plans because either they are doing a comic book series or they plan to do a new TV series or they're doing a book series. And everything you do needs to work with what they do, but can't do what they do. And then what you can still do narrows down extremely. And, you know, and then you have to write very, the developers of the games have to write very specific outlines that all have to be approved. And then when the writers get to writing, they have to write exactly to outline. So you can't contact the developer and be like, oh, I have this creative idea, can I put that in? Because no, approvals took a month. We're not going back to approvals. You just need to write to spec exactly. And that's the opposite end of the spectrum. Most games are kind of in between, because if they didn't want you to have some leeway, they wouldn't be licensing a role-playing game. But yeah, it depends a lot on what the IP holder wants to do with the IP. Like, are they planning to reboot? And if so, are they worried about whether the IP is going to interfere with what they're doing? But you also have the opposite end where I didn't work on that. But there was, and I only know this from NNews and other websites, so I'm sure you've all heard the same news, but there was this TV series on Netflix that had an affiliated role-playing game, and apparently at some point they used stuff that the role-playing game writers came up with in the TV series, but then they nixed the role-playing game and didn't pay those people because they nixed the game, and then the game people were like, yeah, but you did absolutely use stuff that we wrote. Anyway, it was on the news. If you know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. And otherwise, I won't name names, but it has been all over Nworld and every other major RPG outlet.
That's what's really scary about some of these big IPs is that they have lawyers that can actually use their lawyer power, which for me, like, I just really designed in the indie space. All of the existing IPs I've ever designed for have been also small press, use a term that Craig has introduced me to.
That I coined earlier today. I came up with it. I've heard plenty of people call... Yeah, I'm starting to like the term small press better than indie, because indie is so vague.
I like that too. Yeah, but they've been small press, IPs. Even if I did do something that they didn't like, they don't have as much of that firepower against me. Plus, it's a little bit more personal. But if I were going up against, let's say, Disney, I would be crushed under the foot of Walt.
It wouldn't even matter if you were legally in the clear. Right. They would just throw so much fire at power at you. It wouldn't matter that you're right.
And hopefully then, too, your contracts are nice. I would really, like, I'm sure a lot of these IP contracts also involve NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, and all sorts of legal avenues for them to pursue you. If you were to leak any of this information, let it slip to the wrong people, let it slip at all. Again, similar to what you were talking about, Steffi, with the role-playing game you were just mentioning, because they also got into a little bit of trouble, as far as I read, at least. Allegedly.
Yes, this is all based on what we read, so don't come at us. Go to the people who wrote this. But yeah, and the NDAs are real. Like, Welcome to Night Vale, I know I can talk about its existence because it has been announced, and I'm hoping I can say that I wrote for it. But nothing else. I can't tell you what I wrote what we're doing, how far it's along, because like I did sign an NDA and I haven't been cleared on anything else. And I prefer to err on the side of caution. So for all I know, they are making massive updates and I just don't know about it.
Something to think about too, if dear listener, you are looking at trying to, you know, get in on doing some freelancing for some of these jobs, and it varies. This is my understanding, and Steffi, you can tell me if I'm wrong, or expound upon it as you will, that because it's a license, it's often linked to a certain number of products or a certain period of time or both that they're going to, you know, the license is good for, like the IP, the studio or the creator or whoever is giving license to this role-playing game company to make this game. And we're going to do, you know, a core game, and we're going to have a starter adventure, and we're going to do a few other supplements, and it's all going to happen in 3 years. And that's when the license terminates. Now it can be extended, but it may terminate at that point. It's one of the reasons that we've seen Star Wars type stuff done by 17 different studios, because they keep, you know, the license last and then they go to somebody else. And so, like, from the freelancer point of view, like, it can be a dream job. Absolutely. I know a number of people who have worked on stuff, and it sounds like, Steffi, you really enjoy working on these, and you're fans of the IPs that you're working on. And I know other people who are very much that way. It's like, oh, I get to work on Star Trek stuff, or, oh, I get to work on Stargate. That, you know, you have to also temper that with, like, I got involved in some of this stuff, but I'm not going to be working on Star Trek for the next 10 years. I'm not going to be working on Stargate for the next 10 years. Just, you know, be prepared for that sort of thing if you're going into it, because you may only get so much. Even if they really love you and they want to use you on every book, there may only be a very specific number of books that are going to happen in a short period of time.
Yeah, you have to keep in mind that companies have their own people. And if the license transfers, they're going to put their own people on the license. They're not going to hire the people who work from a different company. They technically can, because we're all freelancers, but I loved working on some IPs that moved to a different company, and that company simply chose not to hire me, which, you know, that's their right. They have their own writers that they love to work with. And I was really crushed by that, because it was one of my favorite things to work on. I loved it so much, and I had so many new ideas that I wanted to pitch. I think I actually had pitched ideas, like I had outlines ready for books that I wanted to develop with the old company, and they were taking those outlines under considerations, and then the license shifted to a new company and all of that was gone. Like, that's it. I didn't have an in with that new company, which means I can email them, but I'm just like one of 1,000 freelancers that are emailing them saying, oh, I love this IP, can I work on that? And the only thing that I can say that the others can't is I can say I used to work on it, but I don't know if they want to continue in that direction, which means that I used to work on it is a boon, or if they want to plant something completely new, in which case I used to work on it is going to be like, don't hire this person. Mm. So yeah, you're completely at the mercy of whoever happens to have the IP. It's not yours. You are not attached to it. You are working for a company, and if the IP shifts, you don't move along with it.
Yeah, and that can happen for a license that's not IP specific. This sort of thing happened with me. I had 3 articles written and in the pipeline for Dragon and Dungeon magazines when they were physical magazines being published by Paizo. Mm-hmm. And then Wizards of the Coast killed the license with Paizo to do the magazines, which ultimately led them to doing Pathfinder, and they took back the magazines and they did the digital magazines. And I did get some work on those, but the 3 things that I had finished and were like pitched and in the pipeline, and they're probably going to happen. Poof, gone.
Yes.
I inquired with Wizards. They were not interested in doing those things because they had their own plan for what they were going to do with the magazines. Yes, just exactly. Like the new company is going to have their own plan for what they're going to do with the IP.
Yes. Yes, and you have to take in mind the practicality of, technically speaking, under most contracts, they are only obligated to pay you for what they will publish. So that also means, and I've worked for very good companies where even if the piece didn't get published, they were like, no, but we asked you to write it, and you did write it, so we're going to pay you. We're not going to publish it, but here's your money, which, you know, fine by me. But I have industry colleagues who wrote on something and then the IP, either the project got canned or the IP shifted and subsequently the project got canned and they didn't get paid for the work that they did because it didn't get published. It didn't even get passed because sometimes you get paid in like on your first draft and then on your second draft and then on your final draft or on your first and your final and on publication. But a lot of them have some sort of publication clause worked in and it never got published or it didn't even get past red lines. And that means that, you know, you're at the mercy of the company being decent and paying you for the work that you did, because technically they don't have to. And I've been very lucky in that regard. But I know friends who never got paid and they were out like thousands of dollars. And that is just a nature. That is just a reality of the industry, unfortunately.
It's one of the downsides there. I feel like there's a lot of money available in IPs, and a lot of people that I know and I work with in a loose form, my other small press colleagues, they are pursuing IPs. It feels like more and more. I know several people now who have gotten the rights to make the RPG of a certain IP, and they're producing it. And there's a lot of money to be had in them because a lot of times these entertainment companies have way more money than we do as game designers. But the payoff, the you get more money. However, it's not really your product, and it's not really at that point your labor. You are signing off to get paid for your labor, hopefully in the end. And you are really at the mercy of the contracts, and making sure that you have a good contract, I think, is that's another topic for another day.
You want to include, you always want to include a kill clause. Like if the project gets killed, I get paid. But a lot of them just don't have that, and then you're stuck contacting people and asking, hey, I will say that if you feel like you can't ask for a kill clause, maybe reconsider this company. And if you asked and they reacted badly, also reconsider, because I work with a lot of people that I trust. For example, Craig, I didn't even check if your contract has a kill clause. I have no idea, because I trusted you to pay me no matter what.
It does not. At Nerdburger Games, always pays upon completion. Ching.
Perfect.
Always. Every single thing I have ever done, every single contract, and will ever do, pay upon completion.
Perfect. Yeah. See, and I had one company where I asked and they put it in. But if I asked someone and they made a fuss about it, I would take that as a red flag.
Yeah.
It's on you at that point. You make the decision. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a red flag. Am I going to take that risk? And I know that risk exists.
Exactly. Yeah.
Or am I going to walk away and say, I don't need that headache in my life.
Yeah. There are absolutely some IPs. You have to make that call. There are absolutely some IPs that if I were offered it, even if the contract was the worst thing in the world, I'd be like, I'll do it anyway. I love this project so much. And I know that that's me going against everything I've ever said, but.
And that attitude is common amongst many, many people working freelance in the industry. Yes. And it is the reason that people get screwed out of money like this, because the company says, okay, Jess, you did a whole bunch of work. We're not going to do this project or a shifted license or whatever happened. So we're not going to pay you. What are you going to do? Go after the big company with all the lawyers? No, maybe you're going to complain about it to your friends. And then the company is going to move on to the 500 other people just like you that would give their, you know, left pinky to be able to write for that game.
Yep. Yeah. And I will say that I've been lucky. So this is, if I ever worked for you, this is not about you, because I've been treated very fairly by all the major IP holders. But I do know of, because there's a grapevine in the industry, like you can absolutely get away with screwing over your contractors, and then we will tell all of our friends. Mm-hmm. But I also know that there's a particular IP that pays literal pennies to their writers, because they have a huge fan base and they know that if their writers quit, they can get new ones who will also work for pennies, which I have never done, will never do. So if I'm working for you, then you pay me enough. Thank you. because I have bills to pay, but also I wouldn't want to. Like, if you value me that little, then I don't care how much I love the IP, because you don't care about me.
And that is I think also that is part of what establishes more solidarity in our industry. We have to, that's why I feel like if we're so spread out everywhere right now as RPG writers and designers, having some sort of solid, like, this is how much you pay us and we won't work for less and you can't find anyone who works for less. It makes things, I was saying very tongue in cheek that there are companies I would work for nothing. That's not actually true, but it's how I would feel. I feel very conflicted. But we need it. You have to stand up for your own rights, because when you stand up for your own rights and your own working conditions, you're also standing up for everybody else's working conditions. And the moment you cave, that's when you're contributing more to these companies that will do unethical things, such as pay people, yes, pennies, or kill the contract and kill the project and not pay out your contract. Yep. All of these things that I think are bad behavior.
We absolutely need a union. It doesn't help that a lot of people have a day job and they do this on the side. If you make a decent living doing whatever it is that you do, and you want to write for I don't know, the Boink game, because you happen to love the Boink game, and you would do it for free, so the pennies are a bonus. Mm. Okay, fine. But that's different.
You're hurting the people who are trying to establish a baseline for fair pay for people who are trying to do this professionally as their income.
Yeah, exactly. And I also wonder if the Boink game is going to be as good as, for example, because I also work for Renegade on their My Little Pony game, and I worked for Magpie on the Avatar game. And I happen to know that I'm a really good writer. And I also know that everybody else that I worked with on those games with them are really good writers, because they pay the money that attracts really good writers, mm-hmm, professionals who meet their deadlines and who stick to an outline and who communicate and who know the system and who read what you sent them. You get what you pay for. So the Boink game, paying pennies, I don't think it's going to be as good as the Avatar game or the My Little Pony game that actually pays people what they're worth.
That's 100% true as well. And that's a lesson for people who are out there getting IPs of their favorite whatever, making sure that you are paying your freelancers and your artists who are maybe probably big fans if they want to work in that in the first place. And I think paying people who actually really appreciate the IP gets you some really cool results as well. You can always tell when there's a lot of passion behind a project, and you want to make sure that you are staying in their good graces. Number one, number two, you're contributing to positive things in our industry. And number three, like you said, the more you pay, the better the people who are writing for you will be.
Yes, absolutely. And also, like, you're not just paying me for the words, you're paying me for the fact that I keep my deadlines. I will communicate with you. I will communicate with the other writers. I can follow instructions and I can read an outline. Mm-hmm. And that is harder than it sounds. Everybody who's ever had to develop a book knows that that can be tricky. Because I've had people send me amazing work and I was like, but you didn't read the outline. I love what you wrote and I cannot use this. Mm-hmm.
Craig, you probably have some experience, not with that specifically, but the fact that you have some IPs, I will consider, like, for example, your Capers system. You have a lot of free writers working for Capers. They're writing within this IP. You probably have experience getting good people on board, probably. You have good experience getting people on board with that. So I'll let you take over from there.
A quick note that I was thinking of, too, while you were going through, before I touch on, like, hiring people, is we also live in a day and age where we can share the information that, this company, like, screwed over a bunch of writers. We've seen that happen with some developers, mm-hmm, and writer and companies that have, you know, kind of screwed over writers and other artists and graphic designers and editors and contributors. You know, there was a time, you know, like 25 years ago, if you were working on such and such an IP and the company that, you know, was licensing the IP out kind of screwed a bunch of writers over, who are you going to tell? 12 people at Gen Con that, you know, 12 other writers that might want to be interested in working on that. But here you can make a fuss on the internet and you can, like, let everybody know that, hey, these people are being bad news in our industry.
You can tell 1,200 people on Twitter
in 140 characters or less. but anyway, I mean, whenever I see the term IP, I always think of like, you know, well, it's like the IP that everybody consumes. And like, I don't think of capers as being an IP, but I guess technically it is. It's, you know, it's multiple setting periods and multiple game books. And I've, you know, I've had to go looking for people, and I've being small press, as they say, you know, I can't necessarily, I try to pay well, I try to pay as best I can. And I tailor my expectations to what I'm asking, what I can offer to pay as well too, where I'm going to give people like, here's an adventure. Like when I did, both the people here, everybody listening, wrote an adventure for Capers Adventures, which is coming, Capers Cyberpunk Adventures, which is coming soon. And so I had an adventure written, and I had the world stuff, you know, in the game book and everything. And I communicated some information to everybody and kind of got the point across about what the world is and everything. And then I knew that, like, I'm going to, like, unless the person comes back, I went hard with outlines. I want, or at least ideas. I wanted everybody to kind of give me an idea of what they're planning to do to make sure we didn't have adventures that were overlapping. I didn't want two adventures that were heavy on like, oh, an evil AI. I wanted just one adventure about an evil AI, and there is one. and you know, some of those things, and make sure we're kind of like not, we're not all using the same mega corporation as the bad guy. And then, but once it was kind of beyond that, I just kind of like let people explore, like, what's the type of story they want to tell in the world of Capers. And so, I think with both, in both your cases, I think with everybody, there was very little. I think maybe two of the adventures out of the seven, six writers, one of them was mine. I did a little massaging. I had some people tweak some things to make it kind of go a little differently. But mostly it was like, you know, I've given you the edges of the racetrack. You can bounce your car around that racetrack as much as you want when you write the thing. So like, give a lot of freedom. And so that's something to keep in mind too, is like, if you're as a freelancer, if you're looking, if you're getting a lot of freedom, you know, like, versus not a lot of freedom, like, you have to kind of tailor your expectations to what the project is and what you're getting paid and what the deadlines are going to be like that. You know, you keep kind of keep that in mind, take that all into account. If you're looking to hire people to work on your game or an IP such as it is of your game, is try to, you know, I do your best that you can, and find ways. Like, I go out of my way with all my convention help stuff, with hiring people to work on stuff. I try to go out of my way to provide as much information as I can, and then provide as much freedom beyond that. So that it just makes it an easier process to work with. But that's because I am not, you know, Capers is not a multi-billion dollar IP where like a misstep could really upset all of my investors, which I don't have. Well, I do have one investor, and I am him. So
I was like, hold on, what, Craig? You have an investor?
Yeah. So it's a, from my point of view, when it comes to kind of getting people to work on something, I'm very freeform on all of that. I hope I wasn't speaking for you too much when I said that, but I think I gave both of you pretty broad freedom on like here's a world that it is, and just like write a cool story that fits in that world. And because I got six, like you said, Steffi, good writers, I got six very different ideas, and I just made sure little nuances didn't cross over with each other too much. And I had to, you know, kind of rein in an AI idea one time because everybody wanted to write it. Well, not everybody, but there were multiple people who wanted to write something about an AI because it's very much in the public consciousness right now. So we had to make sure that that didn't go that way. But otherwise, you know, lots of freedom. Yeah. Boundaries a little bit.
Yes. And I think it's also good as the writer to recognize that the developer is doing what can within a confines that he had. For example, if I'm going to miss my deadline, I would ask you, and then you confer with Craig, and then you come back to me and you're like, yes, sure, you can get an extension. But if you work on it, most developers will already have built in like some leeway, because it very rarely happens that everybody makes their deadline. So most developers will be like, yeah, if you're 2 weeks late, that fine, I was going to count on people being 2 weeks late. But sometimes on big problem or big projects, what happens is that they have an agreement with the parent company that all the stuff has to be in by this date, because that is when, you know, the big people getting paid big money at the parent company are going to read it and are going to put it through approvals. And no, they are not cool if you're a week late. So as a writer, you have to be aware that if the developer says, absolutely not, I need it by this date, and if you can't do it, I need to replace you, they are not being mean to you. They are working within very strict confines, and that does happen if you come within these very, very big IPs, and it depends a little on the parent company. But yeah, there have been non-negotiable deadlines in my work. And it also helps if the developer tells you from the start, like, you cannot miss this one. I have no room for you here, which means I might have to move other projects around or tell the developer early on, like, I'm sorry, everybody in my household got sick. My cat is sick. Everyone is puking. I won't be making this deadline. Find somebody else. But it's good to realize that as a writer, they are not trying to get you off the project. It's just that they can't move.
There are other things that people have to do after you send in your writing too. There has to be editing, yes,
exactly.
Layout.
Yeah, exactly. It has to go to, yes. And if you, and editing, layout, everything within the company can usually be moved around. It's fine. But once an external force comes in for approvals, then you're kind of stuck with that date. Mm-hmm. And depending on how big the external force is, the harder it's going to be for them to move around, because they're like, no, you're like the smallest bit of our company. I'm not moving my schedule because the RP is missing its deadline.
A good point to keep in mind too, as Sevi said, you know, hitting your deadlines, establish a reputation as someone who always hits their deadlines, because when that situation comes up that somebody else has life blow up in their face and can't hit something, they're going to suddenly need to find somebody to fill in. And if you are somebody who always hits a deadline and is always ready to go and is communicative and is on top of things, then you might be the person that helps to fill that in and make sure that it all happens.
Yeah. Absolutely. And also, if you are the person whose life has blown up, the chances of them being gracious and giving you an extra week or two extra weeks and then still hiring you are also pretty high, because they knew that that was a fluke. Whereas if you go in and you miss your first deadline, then you are now the person who misses their deadlines. That's it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's important to establish, like, I usually, because I missed one recently, and I was like, that doesn't usually happen to me. I've just had this weird string of bad luck and everything fell behind. And you're the one that I couldn't catch up on. But if that is your 12th project with them and the other 11 were fine, then they will be like, yeah, no, I get it. It's fine. I believe you that this is a weird thing and a weird situation, and it's fine. We'll hire you for project 13.
It's rougher at the very beginning for that sort of thing, because you haven't established a reputation yet.
Yeah, because I can tell people I never miss a deadline, but if I missed yours on my first project, you know.
As somebody who hires people for various things all the time, I find myself thinking, and this is the way I think of it, and I know other people do it, other companies do it, is I'm looking for great people to do the thing. But when I put a call out, I get a whole bunch of people saying they're interested. I'm looking for people that look like they can do the thing I'm looking for, but I'm also looking for people that don't look like they can do the thing. There's a way to, you know, you weed things out. You'll be like, you know, this is, I've heard about this person, or I've worked with them before and they were kind of a pain, or they had trouble hitting a deadline, or didn't communicate, or whatever it is that was like the thing that kind of set you, made it not, you know, put a bad taste in your mouth. When you're dealing with the IP kind of stuff, because like you said, they're very in high demand. There's always somebody that's looking to do that, to take your spot, to do the next project. Yes. To kind of keep that in mind. And, you know, you have to prepare yourself for that sort of mindset and pressure too. You're going to deal with that if you want to kind of keep up with the IP kind of stuff.
Yeah. And I love the IP is not enough to get hired. For example, I'm a huge Night Vale fan. I think I've listened to the project, to the podcast within the first couple of episodes that they did. And then I listened to all of them, and I've been to a bunch of live shows. I absolutely love it. But I didn't get on that project because I love the IP. I got on that project because I worked for other people at the same company, and I emailed all of them. I was like, could you put in a good word for me and tell them that I read my outlines and I deliver good work and I need minimal red lines and I meet my deadlines. And also I'm a huge fan. And then two of them actually did contact the guy in charge of Night Vale, and that's how I got hired. So I'm a fan isn't enough. You're going to need to show that you can do the work. It happens a lot. If anybody on the Tomb Raider RPG is listening to this, I sent you a cold message. But that meant I messaged them. I didn't hear back because they don't know me and I don't know anyone at that company to talk to them for me. But I was able to find on Night Vale, I was able to find people from My Little Pony and another IP who both went to the Night Vale person. And were like, oh, you know who's amazing? Steffi. And then he contacted me and I got on the project. So having people vouch for you because you deliver good work is going to make all the difference. But also, if you're the Tomb Raider person, please email me. I'm in your inbox somewhere, I swear.
And honestly, that works in the small press indie world too.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I tell people, I tell other people, you should hire this person all the time. I share people around. When somebody asks me, who'd be a good, you know, who'd be a good person to write on this kind of thing? I'd be like, well, I worked with this person. I know they can do, you know, sci-fi monsters. You want more sci-fi monsters? They got great ideas for sci-fi monsters.
I got hired on a job because they were looking for an anti-capitalist anarchist. And one of my developers was like, oh, yeah, you need Steffi. I was like,
oh, Steffi.
And then I got that part. And I was like, oh, this is so anti-capitalist and anarchist. This is right up my wheelhouse. And he was like, yes, that is why we hired you. Thank you.
You and I would have so much to talk about.
I saw Jess's eyes light up when you said that.
That is also me.
Yes. So the money isn't real. And we'll go from there.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah, but it was funny because I didn't know that that's why they hired me. So I was like, oh, this is an amazing coincidence. I know exactly what to do. And I told them that. And they were like, yes, yes, that is how you came recommended. Thank you.
You were vetted.
I think that also shows like what the importance of like being expressive and being your own person is as well when you're establishing yourself as a freelance independent writer or whatever you're doing, because there are going to be people who will reach out to you because of who you are and the things that you stand for and the things you talk about and the things that you write about.
Yeah,
I think all of that's true. Not just the professional aspect, but also your own personal and political aspects as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And it doesn't work for every game. Like I got hired in the new Vampire, not the Masquerade, the Requiem. I got hired to write the venture who I like, the business people. And obviously, you can't be anti-capitalist, anarchist going in writing. You can be a little, actually, because that's where the edge is and that's what people like to play. The part that goes, this is a pyramid scheme and everybody in it knows that it's a pyramid scheme, but they are all counting on getting in early enough. Everybody knows this is a scam. So you can, that's where the edge is. But no, you can't go in there and starting with, so the money is an illusion. because that is not the vibe for the game.
Steffi, this has been an absolutely amazing talk. I'm glad that we got the chance to sit down and discuss this because you have so much knowledge on the subject. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Where can we learn more about you or maybe find your work if people are interested?
I am the easiest place still to find me is on the Dying Bird website, where you can find me as Steffi Levan. If you search for that, you'll probably find me. My handle officially is 100. That's the number, 100 things I love. And then you can find my link tree, which has everything in it, including some indie games that I did that you might still be able to snag the last copies of. One is about a dying city set in the giant rotting womb of an ancient colossus who is not quite dead and not quite alive. So that's a lot of fun. There is no money in that game, so don't worry, there is no capitalism. And it also has my websites, my website with my portfolio and my writing samples.
You can find me at wannabegames.com. I finally have released the PDF for The Coven of PS13, which is an RPG about a group of high school witches preparing for the Night of the Full Moon. You can find that game at wannabegames.com, DriveThruRPG, or on Itch under Wannabe Games.
And I'm Nerdburger Craig on various social medias. The website is nerdburgergames.com, and the games are at DriveThruRPG.com. And Hypersleep Terminated, a GM-less space disaster game, is coming soon. I was working on layout today. I showed Jess some of it earlier.
Thank you to our opening and closing theme song, which is Avail by Steph Sachs, licensed under Creative Commons. Thank you, Steph Sachs, and thank all of you for listening. We'll see you back here next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.